it was in the days of my youth. In a previous session, you asked about the games we played, and I said baseball. Well, that was a little loose, because baseball was never a full team. They made changes as we went along. I'm sure Abner Doubleday would never have recognized the thing. And it gave Benny a good argument. Not to fight, but just a good argument. Those were the days of the William S. Hart and the Perils of Pauline movies. And many of those scenes were reenacted in the yards and playing cowboys and Indians. Then there was a game that we called Mumbly Peg. How you spell it, I don't know. It was consisted of pitching a knife or tossing a knife from various parts of your anatomy onto the ground. And the blade must stick in the ground and not incline from the perpendicular by more than 60 degrees. This you measured by putting your two fingers under the handle of the knife. Then there was a game called Red Light. And another was Statue. And then there was the old favorite of hide and seek, and on many a summer evening you could hear the call of Ollie Ollie Outs in Free. Homes in those days were heated largely by coal stoves or by fireplaces. So at the back of each yard was a little building called the coal house. The coal driver would come up the alley and scoop from his wagon the coal into the coal house. Then the householder would come out and carry the coal into the house, bucket at a time, to burn in these stoves. The ashes then were carried out and spread into the alley to fill the holes and ruts made by the coal wagons. Water supply to the homes, while city water was available, was largely from wells and cisterns. Many of the people preferred well water to the city water to drink. This probably accounts for the fact that summer times we had numerous cases of typhoid fever, since sterilization of water was not well understood. The water in the cistern came from the roofs of the houses, and which collected the rainwater or snow water. And while it was ultimately soft, it was to be used only very sparingly, because we never knew when the Lord was going to replenish the supply. And it was only used for shampooing of hair and for very delicate washing, since it lathered readily and the well water just didn't. Also, at the back of each household lot, or in many household lots at least, there was a barn which served as a home for the family horse and sometimes the family cow. The horse, of course, spent his days delivering the people around the city by means of a buggy or saddle, and the cow was milked in early morning and then driven to pasture where she spent the day and then came back in the evening time for milking. The milk was always put through a strainer and then poured into stone crocks where the cream was allowed to rise to the top. The cream was then skimmed off and used for a table use for coffee and to pour over fruit and so on. And the rest of the milk was used as needed by the kitchen. Some of it was allowed to sour, and from this was made homemade butter, which was, and what I remember, very delicious. Also, along with a family barn, was usually a chicken coop, which consisted of the family flock. The family flock provided the family with both chicken and eggs for their consumption. This was before the days of the giant hatcheries where you went down and bought baby chicks. In these days, the mother hen sat on the eggs and hatched the babies and then tended them until they were big enough. And they usually didn't reach frying age till around the 1st of July. Homes were illuminated either by kerosene lamps or by illuminating gas, not natural gas as we know it today. The coal oil lamps had to be cleaned every morning because the chimneys got smoked up, and they had to be filled to keep the oil supply plentiful. You went up to the neighborhood grocery, which was only a block or so away in most neighborhoods, and there you obtained in your own can a half gallon of kerosene. And when you started home, the grocer always stuck a little potato on the spout to keep the oil from pouring out on your way home. The gas lights, as we mentioned, where burned with gas burned on a Welsbach mantle. The mantles were ever so delicate, but they were enclosed in a glass bulb to keep the wind from breaking them. And each home had a little gadget, and a kind of a 3 or 4 foot long rod with a taper on one end and a little wrench for opening and closing the valves on the lights, so that you light or turned on the light, and with the taper you lit the mantles. It gave a very beautiful light with only a slight hissing sound. I forgot to mention this gas was a homemade gas and was generated in a plant down on Broadway between Main and Wood. It's the site now of the Illinois Power Transformer Bank that stands there. While thinking of the public utilities, in the early days, Decatur had two phone companies. The old phone, which was an operator-assisted operation, and then the new phone, which was a dial phone. In spite of the fact that there were two phone companies, not everybody in town had a phone. So when in emergencies, they used to sound whistles, particularly the Wabash. If there was a wreck somewhere on the line and they wanted their wrecking crew, or wrecker crew, they would blow the whistle at the roundhouse, and the crew all listened for it and knew when to report to go clean up the wreck. Another use of the whistle, while not that serious, was that Milliken used to always blow a whistle if they had won a ball game, and used to announce the score by long and short blasts. I think it was the long blast was Milliken's score and the short blast was their opponent. It could have been reversed, but that's the way I remember it. There was another indication of problems, or a problem. Whenever a fire occurred, the city waterworks immediately raised the water pressure in the lines so that you could tell by opening the water faucet if or not there was a fire. You may not know where, but you knew if there were a fire. When a childhood disease struck a family, the Board of Health was immediately out and tacked up a red sign on the door announcing the disease and to keep out. And that sign lasted on the door until the patient was cured and safe was no longer contagious. Transportation in and about the city was by horse or by a few motor cars or by streetcar. The local streetcar service was really fantastic. It ran from the present where the old transfer house at the corner of the two main streets, and it extended out to all four corners of the city. It went north to what is now Memorial Hospital, and there was another line that went over to St. Joseph's Hall, which was at that time the Pythian home. Then there were two different lines going to Fairview Park, one from the south side and one on the north side. And then there was one that went out to Riverside, which was out in the southeast corner, and one that went straight east out to Staley's, and they used to go out there to ball games at Staley Field, Wood at 22nd and El Dorado. So for 5 cents and a free transfer, you could ride clear across the city for a 5 cent nickel. I failed to mention that there was the cab service, which was horse-drawn cabs furnished by the Bird Davis. Bird Davis Livery Company, he ran a whole fleet of hacks and delivery vans. There was the cousin of the local streetcar, and that was the interurban car. These ran every hour on the every way. That is, they went to Springfield, Bloomington, Danville, every on the hour. Or every hour, not on the hour necessarily. The station for these cars was down on between Wood and Main at Wood Street, between Water and Main, between opposite the county building now. These cars provided fantastic service. In addition to transportation, the friendly motorman would stop every now and then and pick up a fresh can of milk to bring to Decatur or to some dairy. And quite frequently he would deliver a can or a container of ice cream from Decatur Ice Cream Company. For longer distance traveling, there were the four steam railroads, the Wabash, the Illinois Central, the C&IW, or the CH&D, which is now the B&O, and then there was the Illinois Central and the Pennsylvania, and they crossed there at the local stations. There were trains continually. The Wabash, of course, served St. Louis and Kansas City and connected them to Chicago and to Detroit. The C&IW, or CH&D, or B&O, connected Decatur to Indianapolis and then on to Cincinnati. And the Illinois Central ran from Mattoon to Pena on that little branch. And Pennsylvania went from Terre Haute to Peoria with intermediate stops. The Wabash had really super service to Chicago. They used to have a Pullman car that stood at Morgan Street and the Wabash. And at 9 o'clock at night, you could go down and get on the train and go to bed in your berth and wake up the next morning in Chicago. It was a fantastic trip. And coming back, they had the same kind of service. You could get on in Chicago, go to bed, and wake up in Decatur. As for road travel, there were the general roads as we know them today. West Main Street, though, ran up to Snake Hill. And if you wanted to sell an automobile, you proved to the prospective buyer that it would go up Snake Hill on high. If it didn't, your sale was nixed. Then on the east, there was the old Calford Bridge. Originally, there was a Calford. And I never understood why England could have an Oxford and we had to have a Calford. But anyhow, there was a bridge built there. It was somewhere downstream from the present Staley Bridge. And after you crossed that bridge, you went up another hill that looked like a 45-degree angle. I'm sure it wasn't, but it really put the old Ford to all its business, getting up the hill. And on that road was the old ocean-to-ocean highway that was marked by red bands with two white bands on telephone poles so that you could find your way along, known as the ocean-to-ocean highway. The main road north was known as the Bloomington Road, what else? And then the road that went southwest out of Decatur, which is now 48, was known as the St. Louis Bridge Road. I don't remember that there was any pet name for 51 south now to Macon and Moequa. While on the subject of automobile transportation, it is probably interesting and probably a not well-known fact that Hieronymus Mueller was the first man to die in an automobile accident. It really wasn't an accident as we know it today, but he was replenishing the gas supply in his car and it caught fire and he was seriously burned and died as a result of burns. But he is known as the first automobile casualty in this country. The number of motor cars that have come and gone in my day is tremendous. I remember the old Saxon and the Roamer and the Apperson, the Chalmers, and many, many more. And of course, Decatur had two automobile factories here, the Comet and the Pan American. I think Pan American had something that Ford copied a little later. Pan American had a white radiator. Of course, Ford with his Edsel, he put a white radiator with a little different shape than Pan American had. Then there was a machine made here in town called the Duol. It was, you know, the predecessor of the Jeep. It was high-wheeled and strong and meant to use on either farm or city. You can't speak of early automobiles without the Model T Ford. The Model T was as simple as anything in the world. And I was thinking the other day, instead of an automatic choke, there was just a hook of wire that came through the radiator and to choke the car, you pulled out on the hook, and it was as simple as that. When you got through choking, you let it go. Also, though, with the Ford, if you didn't have the spark lever retracted far enough, the thing would fire in reverse and spin the crank back, and many an arm, right arm, has been broken, but the Ford kicking them, so as it was called in those days. The early Fords were equipped with acetylene and kerosene lights. Acetylene for your headlights and coal oil lamps for the side and tail light. And I remember my father's disgust. He'd go out at night and light all his lights, and then when he came home, they had all been smoked up. He thought somebody had turned them up. Now, whether they did or not, anyhow, they smoked the things all up, and he always had to clean the lenses after a night call. Of course, the Model T Ford had the gas tank under the front seat, and everybody had a yardstick or a meter stick to dip in the tank and see how much gas they had. Unfortunately, going up a steep hill, if you didn't have enough gas in the tank, the gas couldn't get to the engine because it was a gravity feed. None of the cars those days were enclosed. They were all touring cars and had isinglass curtains. When it started to rain, it was a real task to get the curtains on before you got drowned. And many a time, you just as soon drown as to try to fool with the curtains. I almost failed to mention that in those days the nice ladies had electric cars. I remember particularly Miss Ella Race, who had one with flowered seat covers and always had a rose in the vase in their car. In our discussion of the public transportation, we forgot to mention some of the troubles that beset them. The troubles we mentioned were sometimes the boys used to get out and grease the tracks on the slopes so the cars would have trouble getting up and up the hill. But then down by the Stephen Decatur High School, where the trolleys went by on East North Street, the chemistry students used to concoct an explosive of a type and put it on the rails. As the cars went by, there was a bang, bang, bang. Then when Springfield came over here to play, Springfield High, that is, and after the game, when they started back to Springfield on the interurban, it was quite a thing to run, pull the trolley off the interurban and stall it. We have from time to time mentioned the grocery stores of the area, or the era. These were small, what we'd now called mom and pop stores, but I don't remember seeing mom in any of them. They were all located within a block and a half of each other, almost the choice as to which one you went. They were small, but they did a nice neighborhood business. One of my vivid recollections is going up to our local store and picking up a loaf of bread for a whole nickel. The supermarket was not far away. I remember when the Piggly Wiggly and the Handy Dandy came to Decatur, one on North Main and there was another one on North Monroe, right close to our favorite grocery, the Scruggs grocery store. In the downtown areas, there were larger stores. There was the Snurley's, and then there was the Lou Barbie, and they did a tremendous business. A little farther on, then came the George Slanker grocery store. He was down on Church Street. And the larger stores had delivery service. You could call in, and your groceries would be delivered to your door at no extra charge. These grocery stores were not self-service. There was always a very willing clerk ready to run around the store and get what you want and put it in with your order. And there was another very nice young older man that always used to put something in your basket and say, "And now what else?" Up to now, I have failed to mention anything about the entertainment facilities in this town. There were plenty of them. In one block on North Water Street, there were four movie houses. There was the Bijou and the Nickel Bijou side by side on the west side of the street, and on the southeast corner were two, the Gem and the Crystal. These four movie houses were all in the 300 block North Water. In the 400 block was the Empress. My first recollection of the Empress was that they showed The Birth of a Nation. My family all went, but I was refused permission to go. There was another movie house on South Oakland, right where the Lock, Stock, and Barrel is now. I think that was known as the Oakland Avenue Theater. Another movie house was located out on East William, on the north side of the street, about opposite the locker plant out there. Slightly later came the Lincoln Theater, with the two twin organs, which was quite the thing, and when we had to sing along. And then one time, Miss Nita Clark, who was the Baptist church organist, and Miss Edna Bunn, who was the Presbyterian organist, put on a fabulous organ concert on those two organs. The Lincoln, the Bijou, and the Empress used to have vaudeville acts in their program. Then later on, the Empress brought in a stock company, the Jack Bessie Stock Company, that used to put on a play for a week at a time. The Alhambra movie house was another one that came to town. It was a little on North Water and a little farther north, up around King or Green. In the summertime, there used to be a Chautauqua on the back end of the Millikan campus. There's where I met the gal I finally married. I was taking tickets, and she was a regular attender, and it was love at first sight. One cannot talk of the movie houses and theaters downtown without remembering the fancy confectionaries. There was the Empress and the Princess and the Chocolate Shop all along on North Water Street, and did they make the most wonderful sodas, and they had the best candies. It was really a treat, and just to walk in and smell was fantastic. In addition to the ones I just mentioned, there was Sam's up on the Lincoln Square, and that was just as good or better than the rest of them. Trying to remember all of the shops that were in and around the central part of the city is a bit of a problem. I'm going to try to recall them. I may miss one, and it's not intentional if I do. First, there was Lynn and Scruggs, and then there was Osgoods, and then Stewart's, H.S. Gephardt, and the William Gushard Company, all in the dry goods business. The William Gushard Company had an interesting way of recording sales. When you made a purchase, you gave the clerk your money, and she would call a check girl, and the little girl in the white midi blouse would come and get the money and take it up to the office and pay for your item. In the line of men's clothes, there was Blakeney & Plum, Kaufman's, and Neustadt that I can remember real quickly. H.S. Gephardt merged with the Gushard Company in the late 20s, so it became Gephardt Gushard, and Newman took over the old building where the Gephardts had been. Occupied the space now occupied by the Millikan National Bank. When they moved over to the Bachman Brothers and Martin Company, where Quiggle is now, then the Stauber department store took over that building and stayed there until a good many years later when the Millikan Bank took over. Bachman Brothers and Martin was the large department store. It's the building that Quiggle now occupies. Farther north on Wayne Street was People's Department, and then there was another People's Furniture Store, and then there was a Peabody Furniture Store around on East North, where Black & Company is now. And speaking of men's furnishings, I all forgot the Bohan Store, which stood at El Dorado and Broadway. And speaking of restaurants, I certainly forgot a few. Over Blakeney and Plum, which is now Kay's Merchandise Mart, was the Canton Tea Garden. And then a block north on the east side of the street was Hetty's Cafe. On the west side of Lincoln Square, there was Hugh Singleton's restaurant. I also failed to mention Scoville's Furniture Store in talking of the various furniture stores in and around town. One of the gourmet delights was to ride the Wabash and then always eat Wabash apple pie for dessert. You were real clever. You figured your trip to Chicago on the Banner Blue just before noon, so you could have dinner in the diner and apple pie, and then you could come back in the evening and have apple pie again on dinner on the Bluebird. Before Lake Decatur was built, when the Sangamon River was our one river here, there was a bend called Allen's Bend, and I was always told, and I never knew just why, you could count on at least one or two drownings there every year. The stout swimmers were the ones that got caught, and whether it was deep water or some people said it was underground springs that fled into the lake and injected cold water, which gave swimmers cramps. In the 20s, it was the days of the flagpole setting. I don't think Decatur ever did that. But we had a gal who set the rocking chair rocking record in a little tavern out on Lost Bridge Road, somewhere near where Eastmoreland is now. I think the name of the place was the Nightingale. To escape the city in the summertime, many people had homes out at Fair East Park. I remember one of my schoolmates, who used to be excused about 10 minutes of 12, catch an interurban, go out to Fair East Park, eat lunch, and catch an interurban back, and be back by the time school started. That was the kind of service we had those days. One very famous night, Clark Gable, the movie star, was passing through Decatur and couldn't get a room at the Orlando or the St. Nick. So he went out and stayed at the little motel here southwest of town on 48. I think it was called the Happy Hollow in those days. The 1920s were momentous years for Decatur. In the 20s, the A.E. Staley Company threatened to leave Decatur and move to Springfield if they were not supplied with more water, which immediately started the wheels rolling to build the new dam and lake. In the meantime, Mr. Staley built his own dam downstream from the Pleasant Clubhouse. Not only was the building of the lake a great thing for Decatur, it was in the same general era that the Staley office building was completed and the lights were installed on the tower. People used to go out and sit and watch the lights. After you had watched the lights at Staley's, then you drove downtown and watched the play of the lights on the fountain at the M.L. Harry Fountain in Central Park. I think these were unique in the city of Decatur at that time. Neither Chicago nor any place else that I know had them at that early time. Staley lights and then come back to town and stop and watch the M.L. Harry Fountain. Previously, we discussed the chicken flock at the back of the hot lot. Not only did they supply chickens and eggs, but they also consumed the table scraps. We didn't have fancy garbage service that we do today, and so the chickens took care of all that. And the gas we mentioned for illumination was also used for cooking. Many a home had its own gas stove. I don't want to fail to mention Dawson and Breeden as another grocery store. They were the ones that carried the deluxe brands, the super brands. And you could call and they would deliver too. Perhaps the stores like that where you saved money because you didn't have the impulse buying that you have now in the modern supermarket. In the line of theaters, there was one that I have failed to mention. I don't think it lasted too long, but at the corner of Water and El Dorado on the northwest or northeast corner was a row of single-story buildings, and on the roof they had an outdoor movie theater. As I say, I don't think it lasted too long, but I do remember going to see one film. The name of the film escapes me. Because hair cuttings were hard to remove from towels, Mr. Norman developed his own system of washing, and then from that it just bloomed into Norman's Laundry, and it is now Laundry and Dry Cleaning as we know it today. The Norman Barbershop had compressed air to each chair, the little hose, and after cutting, the nice barber would blow all the little cuttings out of your head. And then they would attach a perfume bottle and spray you well so that you smell real sweet. With the coming of radio, the Review put in its own private set in the back rooms at the office building, left it open to the public, and from time to time you could drop in and hear what was coming over the ether waves. Not long after that, the radio transmitter came to Decatur, and it was known as WJBL. The towers and the transmitter were on top of what was then the Gushard building, And at that time, they tried to get WGCO for their call letters, but the Federal Communication Commission didn't quite see that, and so we were assigned WJBL, which eventually converted to WSOI. I note that in previously talking about Bachman Brothers and Martin and Peoples, I referred to them as department stores. They were not department stores, they were furniture stores, and I apologize. I also referred to one of the ice companies as the Consumer. It was originally the Decatur Ice Company, and then later on became the Consumer's Ice. On North Church Street, right across the alley from the Gassman School, stood a building, a temporary building, known as the Tabernacle. That was the building in which Billy Sunday conducted his service when he was in Decatur. One of the startling social events in Decatur was the wedding of Miss Elizabeth Park to Harvey Firestone, Jr. Mr. Firestone, Sr. was a friend of both Henry Ford and Thomas Edison, and they were expected to be here for the wedding. Mr. Edison did not show. Henry Ford was here. It was quite an affair, but World War I, they built barracks at the back of the Millikan campus to serve for the SATC, Students Army Training Corps. A lot of the fellows said it stick around till Christmas. After the war, these were torn down and then rebuilt, or new ones built, in World War II. Earlier on, I made reference to the family icebox. It was better than the old cool well where you put the food down over the water in the well. But there was another problem. The ice melted, and there was a pan under the refrigerator to catch the melted water. You either forgot to empty it, or if you did try to empty it, it spilled on your way to the sink. And then when you put it back, you didn't always get it in the right spot, and you always had a puddle on the floor from the icebox. Then there were some people who were very, very smart and drilled a hole so that the water could drain into the basement or into a pan in the basement. The only trouble was there was a slime that formed in those pipes, and it would overflow on the floor in spite of everything. Previously, I mentioned the Tabernacle that stood on Church Street, and I said across the alley from the Gassman School, forgetting that the Gassman School is gone. It stood where the First Christian Church is now, in the middle of the 400 block North Church on the west side of the street. In the earlier days, the railroad crossings were not guarded by either gates or flashing signals, but by a watchman. The watchman had a little shanty with a stove in it in the wintertime. He sat there so that he could watch the tracks, and when a train approached, he would run out either with a red flag or a stop sign, and at night he had a red lantern to warn people not to cross the tracks. There was a time, too, when downtown traffic got so that we had a traffic cop at the intersections, and then we had a semaphore signal, and then we went so far as to have a little house like a phone booth built in the middle of the street, and the officer sat in there and turned the semaphore to direct traffic either way on the intersection. One cannot speak of vehicular traffic indicator at those early days without mentioning the creosote block pavement. The city fathers put down all the main streets with concrete base covered by 4 to 5 inch thick creosote covered wood, saturated wood blocks. To drive on, they were fantastic, just like a roller rink. But in the summertime, the creosote seeped out, and you didn't dare walk across them. Then came hot weather, and they would expand and blow up. Or comes the wintertime, and they would float away. So it was a beautiful thing to ride on, but not a great success. In discussing the men's shops in Decatur, I see that I left out one. That was Backracks on the Square, sometimes known as Cheap Charlie's. Before the days of the supermarket, there were meat markets in addition to the grocery stores. There was the Parlor Market, the Cash Market, Baisley's Market, and then another one I think was called Eastern. Previously, I talked about whistle signals, and the Wabash Railroad, etc. There was one I forgot, there was a curfew. In the wintertime it was 8, and in summertime it was 9. The Mueller Company blew their whistle at 8 or at 9, and all the juveniles were supposed to be in and off the streets. I never heard of anybody being picked up for curfew violation, but then there was a curfew nevertheless. My memories of World War I are somewhat like a bad dream. I remember very vividly that coal was short, and we always burned candles at night instead of electric illumination to save on coal. Gasoline was in short supply, and if you drove your car on Sunday, you would be called a slacker, and that right loudly and orally right to your face. Sugar, of course, was very, very scarce, and I remember going downtown and coming home with a pound of sugar, which was, you know, a little treasure. I remember the ladies all got together and pooled their sugar supply to bake a birthday cake for one of the members of the group. Along with the memories of World War I go the flu epidemic of 1917 and 18, when people died like flies, and the Millikan home up here, or the Millikan mansion, was converted into an emergency hospital, and every volunteer nurses went up to take care of the people. The doctors and the undertakers were both run ragged. I should have said doctors, ministers, and undertakers were run ragged, taking care of the sick and the dead and the dying. Speaking of the Millikan mansion being a nursing home or a hospital, all the local people wondered how Anna B. Millikan would have thought, or how she would have felt with all the disinfectant and whatnot in her home. This spring weather reminds me that we used to spend much of our time trying to fly kites. I said trying, because we ran and ran and ran, and more often than not, the kites fell and were broken. But we put them together and went back and tried it again. There was also the marbles. I think I failed to mention that. And they used to rule the squares of concrete at the school ground. Instead of making a circle, we just played right there. When the convent at St. Teresa was being built, it was quite an oddity. And it's one of those things that you used to take friends from out of town to see, because it was built on an angle, not on the compass, as most buildings around here are. And it was done that way so that the sun would hit every window once during the day. In the summertime, children made little streetcars out of shoeboxes. You'd cut square holes to represent the windows of a streetcar. And you put a lighted candle inside and a string on the front, and you pulled them down the sidewalk, looking like a small streetcar. During World War I, between the two railroad stations, which is now the parking lot for the Norfolk and Western, or for Amtrak, there was a building for the canteen ladies, the ladies that used to serve goodies to the troops as they came through on the troop trains in World War I. Behind that building was the WCTU water fountain. That, too, is gone, I noticed. On North Edward Street, just west of Harrison, were the Doubt Brothers' greenhouses. And downtown there was their retail store, and that's about where Martin's Jewelry is now. In the store they had a macaw that they used to keep on a perch. They used to flutter around and make noises and scare all the kids. Then down on Greenwood Avenue, right at the entrance to the cemetery, was the Bummer's Box, greenhouse and garden. On the west side of the street was John Bummer's Box garden. And it was a beautiful thing in the summertime. And across the street was his greenhouse, which later became Bromley's greenhouse. Just south of the garden was the Monument Works, which was, again, very handy to the cemetery. Up to now, I have failed to mention the two coal mines over here. There was the Decatur Coal Company on Broadway between Prairie and Main. And just off of South Main Street was the M&C Coal Company. South Main was not much of a thoroughfare at those days, because there was the coal mine, and then Danzeisen Packing Company, which is now the building occupied by Christy Fulce. And then further down was Young's Packing Company, And with, before the subway was built, it was an uphill and across the tracks, which was considered rather a dangerous crossing in those days. But back again to streetcar traffic. In those days, it was mandatory that before crossing streetcar railroad track, the car must come to a complete stop, and the conductor, if available, should had to get out, walk across the tracks, and look both ways, and then motion the car on. When it went to the one-man car, then the one man had to stop the car, walk across the tracks, come back and pick up the car and go on again. Fulrath's shoe store had an animated model of a shoemaker. And I, try as I would, I never caught it operating, but I was always told that the man would sit there and hammer on a pair of shoes as much as I wanted. I never did get to see it actually operate. Back to the streetcars again. There were two streetcar barns on East North. One of them on the north side of the street is adjacent to St. Patrick's school ground and backs up to St. Patrick's Church. The other one across the street, was across the street, served as Bowman Welding Company for years, and I just noticed today that one is gone. But the streetcars were always stored there at night, and where there were pits where they could be serviced and cleaned up before the next day's use. The car barn on the north side of the street has been a foundry and a roller rink. I'm not sure now just what it is, but there it stands in all its glory. Across from the Amtrak station, there was a drugstore known as the Kraft Pharmacy. It was operated by a man affectionately known as Doc Anderson. Doc had his own formula for chocolate syrup, and he made it at home. And from that syrup, Doc could make the most fabulous chocolate sundaes one ever tasted. It's probably a little known fact, but there were two or three brickyards here in Decatur at one time. One of them was out near Nelson Park, I think probably on the golf course now. Another one was out west, somewhere near Fairlawn Cemetery. I think there was one up north. I can't really pinpoint it, but there were at least two or maybe three brickyards here in town. On the east side of the 200 block North Main was another confectionery known as the Broadus Confectionery. And it had the first animated electric sign that I ever remember seeing. It was a model of a glass of ice cream soda, and the flashing lights around the edge represented the carbonated water fizzing. When the transfer house stood at the intersection of the four main streets, there used to be band concerts up on the second floor of the transfer house on warm summer evenings. The transfer house was supposed to have been unique, the only one of its kind. Yet it was a noble idea because all streetcar lines came there. In nice days, you could sit outside on the stone benches and wait for your car, or on inclement weather, you could go inside, and there were restrooms if needed, and a place to buy tickets and whatnot for use on the streetcar line. In my early days, the library and the post office sat opposite each other at the corner, opposite sides of North Main Street at El Dorado. The library was on the west side and the post office on the east side. It's obvious that I do not keep up with the times, and I spoke glibly about St. Teresa's Convent being built on the bias so that the sun would hit every window every day. I drive by and it is now gone. I talk about the streetcar barns on East North and one of them is gone. Police protection was not as we have it today. There were no prowl cars, and occasionally a foot policeman would walk by, and that was all we needed in those days. And the paddy wagon or the Black Mariah or whatever was a horse-drawn vehicle that had a gong on it so that when they had a prisoner on board, they could go charging down the street, ringing the bell for everybody to get out of their way. Before the incandescent bulb became popular and cheap, street lighting was by an arc lamp at each intersection. The lamp was an automatic, but it was suspended in the intersection, at the center of the intersection, and periodically the attendant would come by, lower the lamp, wipe the bulb, and put in a new carbon for the arc. And it was not too unsatisfactory at all. Small boys used to love to pick up the remainder of the carbon that they threw out. What we did with it, I don't know, but it was something to pick up and take home and treasure. Dairy products were delivered to the home by horse-drawn wagons. The horses soon knew the route as well as the man, and from time to time he would load his carrier and stop at two or three houses at one without going back to the wagon, and the horse would plod along and stop at the third house. He knew just where the man was going to be. This was probably more efficient than the present-day motorized vehicle, where the vehicle didn't know where the man was going to be. In discussing fire and police protection in those days, I forgot to mention that telephones were not universal, and on poles, on the telephone poles at various corners through the city, were stationed red fire alarm boxes. To summon the fire department, you broke the glass, turned the key, and then pulled the little hook on the inside, and you stayed at the corner until the fire department arrived so you could tell them where the fire was. Since we did not have patrol cars in those days, and since radio was non-existent at that time, throughout the neighborhoods were blue boxes where the policeman on beat could stop and phone into the office and get any instructions that he needed at that time. I think of the changes that have occurred in Fairview Park. In the early days, the Lincoln Cabin or the courthouse stood on the hill at the west end of the park. To me, it seemed as large as one of the Alps. Later, we used to go out and play on the Civil War cannon that were located there. There was also the bear pen, where there were two black bears on display. Up near where the present Lincoln Cabin is was a pond or a concrete pool with a fence around it and containing various kind of waterfowl. There were duck and geese and swans and all those sort of things. Toward the end of school, obviously in May, there was a Maypole celebration in Fairview Park. All the grade school children from all over town met out there. And some of us just danced in circles, and then a few select got to wrap the maypoles, which was quite a thing. The following is probably an exercise in association. As a small boy, I remember when they built the tower on the First Methodist Church and installed the chimes or the carillon. Thinking of the Methodist Church then, I think of the lighted cross on the top. And the cross was at least endowed by the Clokey family, so the cost of operating the cost is still defrayed by that fund. Speaking of the Clokeys, they lived out in the east side of town, out beyond 22nd Street, and the home they had was known as the Pines. I don't remember the pine trees, but anyhow, the house was known as the Pines. And from that name came the Pines Shopping Center of today.